It is 1918 somewhere over North Texas, and a Curtiss JN4 Jenny is flying along at about 60 miles an hour with the engine running rough. The pilot climbs out of the cockpit, not because the airplane is going down, not because he is bailing out. He climbs out onto the lower wing, into the full blast of the slipstream, reaches toward the cowling and tends to the problem. Then he climbs back in and flies home. His name was Ormer Locklear. And what he did that afternoon out of pure necessity, he would spend the next 2 years turning into the most electrifying performance America had ever seen from the ground. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we are going back to the years just after the First World War, when the sky above small-town America became the greatest show on Earth, and the men and women flying those old Jennies became something close to heroes. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Ormer Leslie Locklear was born in Greenville, Texas in 1891. Before he ever saw an airplane up close, he had already established a reputation around town as a young man who regarded the laws of gravity as negotiable. He climbed things, he jumped off things, he was the kind of person who, when presented with a challenge, asked himself what it would take to do it rather than whether he should. When America entered the First World War, Locklear enlisted in the Army Air Service and ended up at Call Field. Outside of Wichita Falls, Texas, he learned to fly. And if you know anything about the Curtiss JN4 Jenny, you know it was an honest airplane. 90 horsepower, AUX 5 engine, fabric-covered biplane, open cockpit, top speed, somewhere around 75 miles an hour on a good day. It was not a sophisticated machine, but it was forgiving, and pilots either fell in love with it or at least came to respect it. Locklear fell in love with it. Those early Jennies had a habit of developing mechanical problems in flight. The AUX 5 engine was known for its quirks. Carburetor issues, radiator caps that worked loose, fuel problems that needed attention, and Locklear developed a habit that the other pilots thought was somewhere between reckless and completely insane. When something went wrong up there, instead of landing, he would climb out and fix it in the air. He would pull himself out of the cockpit, onto the wing, in the full blast of the slipstream at 50 or 60 miles an hour, tend to the problem, and climb back in. He did this enough times that it stopped being a survival technique and started being an experiment. What else could you do on the outside of a flying airplane? How far could you go? And then the question that would define his life. Could you step from one airplane to another? It took deliberate practice. He studied how two Jennies moved relative to each other in close formation, where the wake turbulence from one wing affected the other, where you could stand and find a pocket of relatively stable air. He thought it through with a mechanic's mind. Then he did it. The first airplane-to-airplane transfer in recorded history was Locklear stepping from the lower wing of one Jenny to the upper wing of another, both airplanes flying at altitude. Think about what that actually demands. Two fabric biplanes in tight formation, both pilots holding position in the slipstream while a man steps between them. The earth 1,000 feet below, the wind absolute and merciless, and this man from Greenville, Texas is stepping across like he is crossing a creek on stepping stones. By early 1919, Locklear was drawing crowds at Call Field on word of mouth alone, and here's where you have to understand what aviation meant to ordinary Americans in that moment. Most people in this country had never been close to a flying airplane. They had read about aviation in the newspapers, maybe seen a photograph, but an actual flying machine overhead was still a genuine wonder. When a Jenny came low over your town, rattling windows and sending chickens scattering, you stopped whatever you were doing, you looked up, and then you followed it out to the field. That was the barnstorming formula. And it was nearly perfect. The pilot would buzz the town to announce his arrival, find a suitable pasture or fairground, and set down. The town would come to him. For a dollar, maybe $2, you could get a ride. 15 minutes over the countryside in an open cockpit, the patchwork of fields laid out below you, the wind pressing hard against your face. For a lot of people, that single flight was the most remarkable experience of their lives. For the stunt show itself, the crowd would gather along the edge of the field. There was no public address system, no announcer. The airplane simply appeared above them, and whatever happened next happened in silence and in full view. When Locklear stood up on the upper wing of that Jenny at altitude, people in the crowd grabbed the arms of whoever was standing next to them. When he stepped between two airplanes in the air, the silence from the ground was total, then came the sound. The term barnstorming itself came from the theater. Traveling stage troops had been moving from town to town for generations, sometimes performing in barns when no proper venue was available. When the aviators took to the countryside after the war, the name followed naturally. After Locklear left the service, he teamed up with a pilot named Milton Elliott, who everyone called Skeets, and another flyer named Shirley Short. They put together a small troop and started working the circuit. Word spread faster than the airplane could fly. There were other wingwalkers by that point. Other barnstormers working the same towns, the same fairgrounds, the same open pastures, but nobody was doing the airplane transfer. That was Locklear's. And it was one of those things that had to be seen to be believed. No newspaper account could prepare you for it. You stood in that field and watched the two Jennies close on each other at altitude, and you watched the figure crawl out onto the wing and step across and stand up on the other airplane. And the crowd went from total silence to something that was less like applause and more like a collective release of breath. Hollywood noticed.
Universal Pictures signed Locklear to make a feature film, The Great Air Robbery, released in 1919, used actual aerial footage of Locklear performing his stunts. Not trick photography, not models. The real thing shot from other airplanes by camera operators hanging out of open cockpits, with their equipment bolted to the wing struts. The film was a significant success. Locklear became a celebrity on a level that only movie stars and champion athletes could reach in that era. Photographed at parties, recognized in restaurants. He had come a long way from carpentry work in Greenville. Now here's where the story turns. Universal moved immediately into a second picture, The Skywayman. And for this one, the producers wanted a night sequence, a dramatic dive toward lights on the ground, simulating a city far below, with Locklear pulling out at the very last possible moment. The shoot was set for the night of August 2, 1920, a field near Glendale, California, arc lights on the ground, the blazing white units used to illuminate movie sets. The plan was for Locklear and Skeets Elliott to take the Jenny up to altitude, dive toward the lights, and pull out at a few hundred feet. The trouble with arc lights is that they are extraordinarily bright, aimed upward into the dark, flying toward them at speed. They destroy your night vision completely. You cannot judge altitude. You cannot judge your rate of descent. You are flying toward a wall of white fire with only the instruments in the cockpit to tell you how close the ground is getting. The cameras were rolling. The airplane began its dive around 9 in the evening. It did not pull out. The Jenny struck the ground at speed. Both Ormer Locklear and Skeets Elliott died that night. Locklear was 28 years old. His body was taken back to Fort Worth. The funeral drew thousands of people. Newspapers across the country ran his photograph on the front page. He had been nationally known for less than 2 years. But in that time, he had done what very few people in any era manage. He had invented a form. Wing walking as performance. Airplane transfers. Formation acrobatics staged for a paying crowd. The barnstorming show as a theatrical event with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Locklear did not invent every component in isolation. Other pilots were already walking on wings before him, but he was the one who understood the grammar of the spectacle. That the audience needed something to follow. That danger alone was not enough, that there had to be a story. The barnstorming era continued for another decade after his death. Operations like the Gates Flying Circus traveled the country with whole teams of pilots and performers. Clyde Pangborn, who the aviation world knew as Upside Down Pangborn for reasons requiring no elaboration, became one of the era's signature showmen. Ivan Gates ran his circus with an almost military precision, booking towns months in advance, managing the whole enterprise like a traveling theater company that happened to have airplanes. At the peak, estimates put something like 5,000 barnstormers active across the United States in any given summer. On a warm weekend, you could find a show within easy driving distance of almost anywhere. The Curtis J. N. Ford Jenny was the backbone of all of it. After the war ended, the government sold off the surplus fleet for almost nothing, $50, $100. Young men who had learned to fly in the service came home to find no civilian aviation industry waiting for them, so they bought a Jenny and went. Later came the standard J-1 and the early Stearman biplanes, sturdier airframes that held up better on rough fields. But the Jenny started it all. The era wound down through the late 1920s. The Air Commerce Act of 1926 required pilot licenses and aircraft certification, which added cost and complexity that the seat of the pants operation had never budgeted for. The Depression put an end to the dollar-a-ride economics for good. Many of the barnstormers moved on. Some went to the early airlines, some flew the airmail routes, some simply stopped. But for roughly that one decade, the barnstormers did something that no government program could have accomplished on its own. They introduced aviation to the American public, not as a military instrument, not as a wealthy man's sport. As something for ordinary people, in ordinary fields, on ordinary Saturday afternoons. A boy who watched a Jenny banking low over his father's cornfield in the summer of 1922 might have gone on to fly from a carrier deck in the Pacific 20 years later because of what he saw that afternoon. That is what the barnstormers gave the country. They seeded the culture. Locklear seeded it more than most. There's a photograph of him standing on the upper wing of a Jenny at altitude, arms spread wide, grinning directly into the camera. The Earth is a long way below. The wind is clearly doing everything in its power to remove him from that wing, and he looks like the most satisfied man who ever lived. 2 years, that is all he had. 2 years at the absolute peak of something nobody had ever done before, in front of crowds who genuinely could not believe their eyes. That is not a short life. That is a concentrated one. Don Dwiggins's book The Barnstormers and the archives of the National Air and Space Museum were the primary sources for today's program. You can find more at radiohanger.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep the shiny side up.